program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
We're back at the races, 10 minutes into hour two. On this Friday, weekend preview at the races, and Nick Tamaro joining us, and of course, everyone, it's all I heard all week long. How did Nick's move go? Everybody was really concerned, Nick, the packing, the unpacking, your concertina, how did that make the trip? Talk about the big move.
The move went well. I'm glad there was a great amount of collective concern. It went off. You know, it was a move. So there were always are a few hitches, but it was. And of course, moving here in the summer is not a ton of fun. Although it's not, we're not at quite maximum heat yet, but we're getting there very, very quickly. So it was a mild high of I think 88 last Friday with a little bit of humidity. So I survived and settled all in. So onward and upward. Well. Hopefully not have to do this again for a while. But, yeah, it didn't affect my Preakness too badly, did affect my Black-Eyed Susan Day and kind of rendered that an afterthought. Didn't get the cable hooked up until later in the day, so I was able to watch a few of the races on my phone. Did see Covfefe in time to watch that exhibition. Just definitely saw the best performance of the day. And Friday's card was great, no matter what, no matter how you slice it. But I was back on the beam for Saturday and certainly enjoyed Preakness Day.
Well, some impressions. You got some analysis from what we saw.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a certain bit of gratification that the War of Will was able to rebound, and you know, look, I think we're at the point where we all have to acknowledge, and I'm saying this mainly because I need to do it. I have probably underrated War of Will a little bit and will not anymore, given that he's just, you know, aside from the Louisiana Derby, where there was obviously a pretty serious incident out of the gate, this is a horse who's shown up every single time, who fires his shot just about every single time, and seems to have the tactical speed and the ability to overcome pretty much any type of adversity. And when you look at it from a pace perspective, yeah, Warrior Charge ran a very, very big race on Saturday, but it's not as if War of Will was ever well out of it or, you know, benefited from some big pace setup. Now, he did get sort of a dream run up the inside. I think the chatter about there being a big rail bias is a little, I don't think that's accurate. But undoubtedly, he was helped by getting a perfect run through on the rail. Great ride by Tyler Gaffalione, and he certainly got him to a comfortable spot in the Preakness, similar to where he was in the Derby. Of course, what happened on the turn in the Derby affected his ability to finish from there. But you're talking about a horse that also won the Risen Star from the 14 on top of a fast pace. So it's not as if War of Will is some horse that's in need of an ideal trip in order to win a big race in a big field. So I'm thankful he's in the hands of somebody like Mark Cassie, because we'll know that he'll run, and he's going to run back in the Belmont, and he should be very, very dangerous in the Belmont. Horses with his running style are, I have always believed, at a decided advantage in a race like the Belmont, where the pace will moderate, and he should be right on top of it, if not setting it, depending on what other horses end up getting sent to the Belmont. And you know, I think that'll certainly make him a, you know, he wins the Belmont, he's pretty much a virtual lock for year-end honors. Doesn't really matter what maximum security does. He'd need to pretty much win out. So I understand the importance of that race. As far as other horses coming out of there and impressions that you get from that, it's obviously time for Improbable to be cut back. And it's also time for us to realize that Improbable has not really made a step forward as a three-year-old. And I wanted it to happen. I thought it was going to happen at some point. It just hasn't happened. And for that matter, it hasn't really happened with Game Winner either. I still hold out a little bit more hope, and I think Improbable will improve by shortening up in distance. But he's a horse now that has had virtually no excuse in two races in a row. Didn't get out of the gate slowly at all in the Preakness. Mike Smith was pumping and driving out of the gate, and he just didn't have any speed. So he's a horse that either the pack has caught up to him, or he needs a cutback, or both, or he's just simply going to be, you know, maybe a grade three, grade two type going long if he can't be effective sprinting. I would say that, you know, there are a couple of others. I don't think there was anybody else in there that we really expected to run well that didn't. I know Owendale was kind of a hot horse, and a lot of people had some strong feelings on him, and myself included, and I thought he ran fine. I know he had to angle out wide in the stretch, and ultimately was probably a little closer to the pace than he needed to be. If you give Owendale ever fast trip, he wins, because he would have been able to just lay back and make that one run, whereas I think being a little closer and kind of dragging Florent Giroux into it a little earlier than he needed to probably hurt him in terms of kind of zapping him a little bit in the final furlong. I also don't think he really probably wants a whole heck of a lot more than a mile and an eighth if he has to be close or in, you know, relative proximity of a strong pace. So I think he'll be a dangerous horse in some races later in the year. I know they're going to go to the Belmont. He's not a horse with I don't like those running styles in the Belmont, and I don't think it's going to be a race that will unfold for him. Bourbon War is a horse who probably needs to find softer competition. I know he's been kind of a bit of a sexy horse on the Derby trail here and there, and people liked his second-place finish in the Fountain of Youth and now in the Florida Derby and the Preakness both. He had kind of a weird trip in the Preakness where I thought he was a little shuffled out, and then he angled out, looked like he could have made a run, and it didn't. So I think what we'll end up figuring out about the Preakness field is that the balance of it behind the top of the top finisher was sort of a hodgepodge of horses that need shorter distances or horses that really aren't quite grade one caliber or had maybe tough trips that kept them from being as effective. So I don't think it's a terribly conclusive race in terms of how the division sits all in all. What we do know at this point is that War of Will is at the top of it, and if he is able to duplicate that kind of performance in the Belmont, then he'll clearly be the leader going into the second half.
Yeah, I got the same. I had the same kind of thought, and then this morning I saw where Jerry Brown had released the figs from the weekend, and you want to look at a curious set of figures. You look at that Preakness for the ground loss, and and as Tony Black has laid out, not a place you can lose ground at Pimlico and be successful. But it tells some interesting stories, and you got a sense that War of Will still has got plenty to give yet, and maybe that misfire in the Louisiana Derby ended up being a blessing.
I think there's an argument to be made. Yeah, it really did. And it certainly was so for the people who wanted to bet on him, because I think you got an inflated price in the – probably ended up getting an inflated price in the Preakness, too, because we all couldn't quantify just how much trouble he may have gotten into. And I don't think his performance on Saturday is an indictment of the people that thought that maybe he was not overwhelmingly affected by the interference in the Derby. What it does say is that he's just a good horse. He's a good horse that, when given a fair shot to show what he has, can be very, very dangerous and can win pretty much at any level. So it's it remains to be seen exactly how much he can step forward. He seems to be able to dance a lot of dances. He's gotten to be just as good on dirt as he was on as he showed early in his career, at least on turf. I didn't expect him to really move forward like this at all. And he has a very interesting pedigree. I know that, you know, I laugh when people bring up pedigree on horses that have run eight or nine times, but this is kind of funny, actually, that He is a half to a horse named Tacticus, not Tacitus, Tacticus, who was a Flaxman horse trained by Graham Motion that won both the Birdstone and the Temperance Hill back in 2015 and then broke down in a training incident prepping for the race that was formerly known as the Breeders' Cup Marathon. I think it was brought back in a slightly different format that year at Keeneland. And so, I mean, obviously, you're talking about serious distance on the dam side. And he was also he's also a half to Pathfork, who was the future book 2000 Guineas favorite back in 2012, and ended up going off one of the favorites in there and lost to Frankel. So this is it's a you know, really a lot more classical type pedigree than I think we all realized early on. And Warfront, I think, if he's not the top stallion in the game, he's getting very, very close to it. So that said, there really shouldn't be a bottom to War of Will distance wise. And he looked like a different horse from the standpoint of being able to stalk and pounce and kick clear on Saturday than he had before. So I'm interested to see what more he has to give. I think if you're looking at the whole card, all in all, you want to say something about Catholic Boy, who it was great to see him back. And we can remark in discussing the Thoroughgraph figures that he got a very stout Thoroughgraph number for his comeback. It was a lifetime top, and this is a horse who had hinted at serious ability both at 2 and 3, and looks as versatile as they come. A grade one winner on both turf and dirt already, and yeah, he was saved by the wire a little bit, but he collapsed the race in there, and it was by no means a slow pace. I thought he ran extremely well off the layoff, and very excited to see him in the Suburban, the Whitney, and anywhere else he'll show up. I think we're gradually getting back to where the handicap division is sort of coming together. I know 2-3 months ago we all thought, oh, God, this is going to be really ugly. But if he's around and Thunder Snow hangs out for the second half of the year, which supposedly he's going to after running in the Met Mile, I think it might be a division that has a little bit more, might be a little bit more robust than we thought, and that would be nice.
Well, and a good second leg, and you know, obviously the three-year-olds are always the glamour part of this, but everything else that goes with it underneath and around. And then, you know, Nick, when we get to Belmont, these 3 days, it really should set things up for the middle part of the year, for the summer. Everything seems in place for, you know, the divisions are all starting to really round out, and boy, the 3-year-old filly sprint division, we never have to worry about the boys heading toward the Allen Jerkins, but boy, the girls certainly got the last couple of weekends. And even if you just concentrate in the Brad Cox barn, the 3-year-old filly sprint division has got itself established.
Holy cow, I mean, that's an embarrassment of riches right now. You think about both Break Even and Covfefe, who I did kind of laugh as she was just rambling through furlong after furlong that Covfefe was wired in the Frisette. But it's just funny how rider intent and the way things shake out can have such an impact. And, you know, look, this was a horse that, I mean, I would have said I thought her comeback race at Keeneland was average. I didn't think she looked particularly great. I thought that that maybe, you know, there was a potential that she needed one. But, I mean, this was not a step forward. This was a quantum leap forward. I mean, this was a very, very strong performance. And I know every speed figure maker and every fan in general wanted to flock to a clock to see if she had actually run that kind of time. I mean, you're talking about a horse that in her debut ran a very, very fast number on any measurable speed figure. So we knew she always had it in her. It was really just a question of when she was going to show it. And I know people around the game, because it's very hard to keep something like this quiet, especially when a horse trains at Churchill, where there are so many quality horses pretty much on a yearly basis. Everyone knew this was one of Brad Cox's favorite horses, and that was why she went off such a short price in her debut. So it was only a matter of time before she really started to strut her stuff. And that was excellent to see. But, yeah, talking about Belmont long range, I mean, we're looking right now at without knowing a whole heck of a lot about who some of the probables are for the races outside of the main ones on Saturday. I mean, you're talking about a 3-day festival right now where Newspaper of Record is going to run on Thursday. I saw Catalina Cruiser is going to come back in the True North on Friday of Belmont week, and then Saturday's races look absolutely loaded, including and probably highlighted by that Met Mile, which right now looks like it's going to be one of the best races in terms of matchups and intriguing fields that we've seen quite possibly in the Met Mile in a very, very long time. It reminds you a little bit of 2015 when we had the sprinters and the routers sort of converging there, but We didn't have names like Mattioli and McKenzie meeting up in that race. Did have Honor Code and Tonalist, Bayern, just not your father's Bayern, Private Zone. So it was a very, very strong group, but it feels a little bit like that. And that's looking at this point. Like, with all due respect to the Belmont, that might be the race that's the most anticipated in terms of how things shake out. Obviously, the Belmont will be plenty anticipated as well. So it's looking like a slate of races that surely is worthy of being referred to as a festival.
One note before we talk about the weekend, Belmont and Monmouth have got tomorrow's cross-country pick five, and we did hit at least one of the races at Monmouth. But Nick, what's your theory on the win prices on that Preakness chart? How did that happen? Why?
Everfast was more like 70 to 80 to 1 in the exotics, and I think that had a lot to do with the public money that probably put people on him, both because of his name and because everyone wanted to have the long shot. So you could see in imputed odds from the double the day before, and of course Marshall Graham is one that tweets a lot about this, that he was about 85 to 1 in the Black Eyed Susan Preakness double, and then in the the race was over, and I was watching it on NBC, and I went and looked at the exacta probables, and I looked at the odds and said, Everfast was 25 to 1. How the hell did that happen? And looked at the exacta probables, and it was just your regular, 9 to 2 over 25 to 1, $947 exacta. So, I mean, looking at it from that perspective, we all kind of knew that it was obviously a drastically different situation. Now, one thing I will say, and I know that Pat Cummings has brought this up as part of his work with the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, that we do need to know a little bit more about why the Kentucky Derby Superfecta didn't pay more. Speaking of odds and payoffs and things like that, because the Preakness Superfecta paid more, and that's a little difficult to believe, given the respective odds of the horse. Obviously, that was a 6 to 1 War of Will, by the way. I said 9 to 2, but I wanted to get that right. I think we need to know a little bit more about how a Superfecta with a 65 to 1 shot on top could pay such a relatively average amount. But yeah, it was definitely a situation where Everfast odds were in the exotics were quite a bit more, and it looked that way in all the things that ended in that spot too. And if you were able to somehow throw an all in there between War of Will and Owendale, you certainly got a very, very handsome payoff.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and you could tell by the exacta and the try and so forth that the prices other than the win was really where it was supposed to be. There's a lesson there, I suppose, Nick, for people. Don't be confused if you're betting the exotics. Don't be confused by that win tote, and don't think, well, I'm not gonna key off of the so and so, whoever it might be, in second and third because they're too low. That win price has no reflection of what they are in the exotic pool. Look at the probables in the exacta, and that'll you'll see right away that the numbers are where you would want them.
Absolutely, and this happens on a pretty regular basis in the bigger races, and I think we had a relatively similar conversation last year about the Preakness itself, where you had Justify, Bravazo, and Tenfold, and it was a situation where Tenfold in the exotics was obviously a lot bigger than he was in terms of his win odds, because that trifecta paid $148 for a dollar, which was way more than it should have been based on their win odds, so... it'll happen. It'll happen in the. It's going to happen in the Belmont. There's going to be a certain amount of money, and I really poo-pooed this idea for a long time, and then I saw how much money my boy Jack got, and it sort of made me think again. Like, hey, you have to remember there is an insane amount of public money bet on the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont. Obviously, not as much in the Preakness and the Belmont, but it is money that is truly uninformed, and it's going to be bet on horses that form-wise doesn't matter. It's being bet on names, it's being bet on colors, being bet on things like that. And I think Everfast was a beneficiary of some of that. I mean, hell, Dale Roman said himself, I couldn't believe he was 25 to 1 afterwards, because anybody looking at the PPs figured figured he had to be. I mean, he was over 100-1 on paper. His form was just brutal coming in, but he got a great ride from Joel Rosario, who's the best off the pace rider in the game, and saved as much ground as possible, so was able to get second. And now his prize for it is going to be dancing all the dances that Dale can get him to.
Well, we'll look forward. We're going to look forward to having you in New York. And meanwhile, let's look at tomorrow, the races from Monmouth. They're going to use that 10th I mentioned in between the two stakes, between the Salvatore Mile and the Monmouth. The 10th, 11th, and 12th are part of this cross-country pick three this year. I take that back. It's the 9th
and 11th, right?
10th, 11th. Yeah. Yeah, 9th. I was looking at the wrong quick sheet. 9th, 10th, 11th. It is those three races that I mentioned, and they combine with the Belmont 9th and 10th. So sequentially starts at 4:30, basically, and then at Monmouth, then the 5 o'clock at Monmouth, the 5:32 at Monmouth, and then 5:51, the Belmont 9th. And the Belmont 10th, and the 9th is the Paradise Creek, which is very interesting because Fog of War is going to take a lot of money, and you better just project that he's going to be, you know, as good coming back as when he left, and he's going to have to be because there's horses that with current form that are, you know, that absolutely are going to take some beating.
Yeah, we've seen this happen quite a few times. Obviously, Chad Brown's stable is so heavily geared towards the second half of the year, and we've seen this happen quite a few times in the last few months with horses coming back off of layoffs. And I think it, just in one weekend at Keeneland, we had it with both Rushing Fall on Saturday and Raging Bull on Friday. And Raging Bull, when you looked at the field he was up against, didn't look like he was appreciably faster or any better than what he was running against based on his three-year-old form. And then on Saturday you had Rushing Fall, whose three-year-old form actually made her better, if not, you know, she was just as good, if not better, than the horses she was running against. This is a situation with Fog of War, and you don't want to be too critical of him because it was just a couple of races at two. He's going to have to take a step forward to beat these horses. It's not as if he's so much better than what he's running against. So I think there's definitely some reason to be a tad critical and to want to look at some other options because there are quite a few. I thought that the horses that I thought would be prices that I wanted to try were Pulsate and Ian Glass. Pulsate's getting back to the turf, has gotten into really good form lately, and won a tough one other than last time at Aqueduct. That race was featured Standard Deviation, of course, whose career has not taken off at all as a three-year-old. And Pulsate was a game winner, staying with it the whole way in the final half mile. And this is a horse really with turf pedigree. He's supposed to be a turf horse. He debuted on the turf and didn't run poorly. Obviously, this is a barn that really doesn't put a premium on getting horses ready early, so I felt like he would be deserving of another shot on the turf. And Ian Glass is probably one of the more interesting horses in here based on the amount of speed he has, the fact that he's been involved in some fast paces recently, and is probably going to be able to get relatively close to the pace. 7 furlongs on the Widener at Belmont is an exceptionally tough trip to wire, so it's hard to be up there and battling the entire way, but I will say that Rosario can probably get him into a comfortable spot, if not on the lead, very, very close to it, because it sure does look like a race where the pace is going to be very moderate. So Pulse Setter ends up getting the lead. I think you could see Ian Glass being just off his flank, ready to pounce, and you'll certainly get some value there. There's going to be a lot of support for Mucho getting to the turf, and Progeny of Blame have not been bad by any means on the turf. This is more of a dirt-oriented pedigree, and I get the feeling that they're just sort of kind of trying something. He's had a couple of siblings try the turf. Both width and length got it at one on the turf. These Claiborne names are funny. I mean, the dam is extent, and her foals so far are level and size, width, length, and Mucho. So not that we're having any kind of double entendre there, but I don't really want to bet on Mucho at 3-1 or 7-2. I know he was a little too close to that hot pace in the Bayshore, and that probably scorched him a bit. Mind Control, a much better, two of the better three-year-old sprinters around, I think. But this is just looks like bad value. I'd rather have more prices with Ian Glass and Pulsate, and I could even find a reason to use Uncapped, who I thought finished up very strongly in the William Walker, and doesn't seem like a horse will have any issue whatsoever with 7 furlongs.
Yeah, I agree on all fronts. Let's stay with New York for a minute before we look at the three races at Monmouth. And so the nightcap, second level allowance, turf sprint, 6 furlongs on the inner turf.
But I'll tell you what, this is a super, super tough race, and you really can go a number of different directions. I think a lot of people who end up relying on Fog of War are going to try and get as deep as they possibly can in here. Final Frontier is the horse to beat, and we all remember Final Frontier, of course, from that closing weekend disqualification where he caused some interference in mid-stretch of a race late on the card. And came back and chased a fast pace in a race won by Clyde's Image, of course, who's now double grade one placed, and ended up closing out his year with a pretty smashing win over a good field. Now comes back off the layoff. There is the uncertainty of the layoff, but, I mean, it goes without saying that if Final Frontier runs back to his last race, he's going to win. And he has a versatile running style to the point where he can be close to the pace if nobody really commits to it. This just looks like a race on paper where there's a ton of speed. So that, I think, becomes the concern with Final Frontier. Is he going to be as effective when he's not sort of sitting on top of the pace like he was last time when he got that big buyer figure? I'm going to use Commute, and I think Commute is the horse that I'd be most interested in betting. He set a really fast pace in his last start. That was on a Florida Derby day, and I think it was the race that kicked off the Rainbow Six, or it was in the middle of the Rainbow Six. I know they ran about 24 races that day. And the pace was fast. The pace was exceptionally fast. He tired late, understandably so. In his prior start, he drew the rail in a tough turf sprint at Gulfstream that was won wire to wire by Fixed Point. Fig Jelly had a very good trip in that race and ended up finishing second. He was inside. He got in behind horses a little bit. It felt like a race that he needed off a short layoff, and now this is a horse that probably had a couple of opportunities down at Monmouth, but Navarro's willing to send him here. I'm going to try him at a little bit of a price. I'm going to use him, certainly going to use Final Frontier, and I have to use anybody who looks like they have any ability and can come from off the pace. So that includes Fig Jelly and Pagliacci, both of whom I think will be doing their best running late, because it just looks like a race where the pace is going to be exceptionally fast if there aren't any scratches with Spectralite and a couple of other speedsters to his inside set to really battle in the early going. Battle Station only has one way to go, so we should see a pretty quick pace.
Well, make sure at 20-1 you use Spring to the Sky, second off the layoff, and if you go back to that pairing last year, I know he's 10 years old and you can make the, you know, might have lost a step, except that performance at Aqueduct in mid-April was very good. And he advances off that as you know, he logically can, second off the layoff, go back to what he did at Saratoga, you know, that last summer. You know, I have such respect for him, and I would jump off the grandstand if I left him off and he, you know, he were to close this sequence out with a win. So and he's going to be a number. How about the 9th, 10th, 11th, the two stakes, and that solid allowance sprint in between for people playing the cross country?
Yeah, this is nothing easy at Monmouth either. It looks like a very challenging sequence all in all. And I thought the Salvatore Mile brought together a pretty, you know, kind of a pretty interesting bunch. You don't know exactly what you're going to get at a two-turn mile this time of year, but it does look like a pretty contentious field. It looks like it should be an honestly run race. Diamond King's a horse to beat and should get a good trip stalking the early pace. I do think there's a couple in here that'll outfoot him early, and he's very much the horse to beat. My opinion is that Sunny Ridge is better around one turn, so I'm not quite as interested, but I think it goes without saying he's been facing better horses, so we shouldn't be surprised if he is able to step forward and get connect in here. I thought I bet Hoffenheim in the Westchester, and I don't think he ran poorly. I know Nicodemus came over the top in that race, and the pace was pretty strong and contested, so I'm willing to give him another try. Ball Harbor, I feel like, is a horse who's pretty dressed up. That being said, his Queens County was very, very good, and he's the type of horse, I think, that can be positioned virtually anywhere early and be effective, so I get the feeling that it's going to be a race where you're going to have to be pretty deep. I think Ball Harbor definitely needs to work his way on your ticket. I'm going to use Hoffenheim as well, and Diamond King as my main horses, and probably back up with a couple. The 10th is a There's a Jersey bred allowance race, as you mentioned before, and this is another one where we've had quite a few perform well at this level. Party on Prospect is looking to make it 2 for 2 for Ray Handel off the claim after winning at this level, and he's able to run at this condition again because he's in for the tag, so willing to give him up for 12.5 after he was taken for 25. But they did get that big purse last time with the inflated money. The Jersey bred's running for almost $60,000. Visionary Ruler's first off the claim for Michelle Knee-High. Now, the difference, the thing there is that this is a claim off of Jorge Navarro, and the horse has been off for 3 weeks. It's one of those, oftentimes you can get kind of a cheeky play and take these horses back off the high-percentage trainers when they're claimed elsewhere, not as if claiming as much of Michelle Nihay's game. So I'm going to probably include Visionary Ruler as a backup. Optic Way is a horse who needs another shot off of a third-place finish at 7-5 last time in the race to Party on Prospect exits. I think it's those three mainly in terms of the ones that were 1, 2, 3 weeks ago at Monmouth. And the Monmouth, I was actually very surprised to see Joe Bravo get off of Synchrony in here. I think I'm wondering if he was actually given the option. But Synchrony is a horse who did well for Bravo, specifically at Monmouth last year, winning the Oceanport and the Red Bank. He gave this horse a couple of really good rides. And he was outclassed last time. He's not a grade one animal in a mile and an eighth. And this is a much more realistic spot from a class standpoint. I think it should be... Probably the biggest question here is, will there be any kind of pace battle between Up the Ante, potentially Market Off, and Irish Straight, or is Up the Ante just quite a bit faster than those other two? And if you believe that Up the Ante might be able to get the lead and establish things in here, Rajiv's a very good rider on the front end, and I think he's actually a horse that you could find an excuse to include at a relatively decent price. Almanar comes back off a short layoff. I thought he was very dull in the Fort Lauderdale. These kind of horses, though, when you leave them out in multi-race sequences for Chad, you end up getting yourself in trouble. So I'm gonna include him. I'm going to include Projected as well. And I think it's going to be a challenge, really, to see where you can get a little bit more clever and cut this thing back.
Excellent. All right. Well, if you get the time, please put together maybe the grid, and I'll get it up on the website.
Absolutely.
All right. Nick, I appreciate it, and enjoy the new home, the new digs, and we'll check in next week.
Sounds great, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Nick Tamaro, NTAM, 1-2, 1-5. There's your cross-country pick five action tomorrow, the 9th, 10th, 11th at Monmouth, the two stakes, and a nice sprint, and then the last two at Belmont. So you get started again, 4:30, and you'll wrap it up at... I'll tell you right away. The last post is 6:24. So 90 minutes. Almost 2 hours. Make it 2 hours. Rick Hammerly standing by. And here's Hammer.
Good morning, Steve. How are you? We're always ready for you. You never know what time. I was getting my hiking gear on, getting ready to go after the show, and got the call from Jalan, and we're ready to roll.
Nice, nice. Well, I'm sorry that we didn't get you over at Pimlico last week, but we kind of winding down the recapping. Get your impressions.
Well, you know, I had a different day for Preakness, obviously, not being at the track. And decided to go over to the local OTB, which is at Ventura, about an hour away. And was different because I was supposed to meet a buddy up there and, you know, go through the day. But he wasn't able to go. So I had an interesting day alone in an OTB. And I'll tell you what, it's a lot different, by yourself, handicapping. And I will say this, I cash a lot more tickets than I normally do. Just psychologically, you're not involved in the old, talking to people and listening to other people's picks and impressions of races. And you just go ahead and do what you think is right. And I had a good day all over the place. You know, when you're by yourself, you can bet two or three or four tracks because you're not distracted talking about the weather or somebody's sister or something like that. So I had a good day up at there. But the Preakness itself, I tell you, we sit back in here and you look at the chart, which I did earlier, but I'm looking at it again this morning as I heard you and Nick going over it. I mean, how does World Will go off at 6-1, first of all? And then I heard you talking about some of the other odds. But I mean, my impression is, as most of it is, was, you know, A, you know, the war of will. I mean, what a great training job by Mark Cassidy just to have this horse in that condition to go through all he's gone through this entire year when you think of all the of his story with, you know, looking good early and then having that mishap and then coming back and running the race in the Derby and getting taken out and being in the news and all of a sudden looking like nothing happened in the Preakness War of Will at 6-1. So very impressed by him, and it was almost, like I said, look back at the chart, how could you even think about anybody else in there? But, you know, Brad Cox's two horses ran well. Dale Roman, he's one of those guys that you just always comes up and bites you if you don't watch out. And the improbable, not really surprised that he didn't run well. Talked about the, you know, California Jinx, and they're just not running well in the big races right now. And some of the other horses just didn't belong. So War Will, now, when it's over, really was a standout. And going forward into the Belmont, as you look at some of the probables in there, I mean, if he's as fit as he was for the Preakness, I don't see too many going to stand in his way there. But very impressed by the job that Mark and his team and Gary Barber, thrilled for them, and just kind of you noticed after he won, we kind of stopped all that talk from the Derby, and it was a well-deserved win.
No, well put, and very true. It's been a fun week actually celebrating it, and we've hit most. Though you know, the one person I I didn't reach out to, I should get. We'll get him in New York leading up to Tyler Gaffleon. We've got to get him.
Yeah,
on,
well, and what a good job by him too as well. I'm not familiar with him as a person at all. I know he wins a lot of races and, you know, was put under the gun there in the Derby and did a real good job, you know, being a professional, answered a few questions after the Derby and sent out a few tweets, but nothing over the line. But to be a cool customer once again and ride in the race and just kind of waiting and knowing he had the horse and having confidence and, you know, and Mark telling him he had the horse and riding a winning race that he did. He's, I mean, I just say a future star. He's a star right now, but he's, I think that gave him a lot of confidence. And we'll see him at the next level here very, very soon.
Well, Hammer, we're going to get you to at least one Triple Crown event, Belmont in a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
you never miss.
That's still, you know, knock on wood, nothing goes on here yet, so we're looking at that. You know, I this morning when I woke up when I read your you know, the review or what's going to happen, I saw the Jim Croupy thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was actually going to tune in because I wanted to hear what he had to say. And then I just went on Google just to see, and I can't believe we lost Jimmy. What a tremendous guy. Just a full, you want to talk about somebody full of life. My gosh, he was just, he was a man and a half. One of the first characters, trainers, whatever you want to call, I met when I went to New Jersey. And once again, because I was, you know, a friend of Humphrey's, I was in, you know, you're Humphrey's guy. He used to call me Rick, you know, Rick the Stick. You're Rick the Stick. And you know, I don't know what to call it, an entourage, but he had a lot of people that looked up to him and conferred with him for advice. And you know, when he was training horses, obviously, when I met him at Monmouth Park, he was in the claiming game, wheeler dealer, and, you know, and with the horses. And, I mean, I'd say, when we called up, we wanted a horse in the afternoon, you just called up Jimmy and I said, hey, we need a horse. Where do you want him? Where do you want him? Put him. Where do you think he can win? Put him in short, long. You know, anywhere from 8,000 to 16.
Hmm.
Won a lot of races. He won a lot of titles. He had good owners. And Bill Martucci was his big owner when I started out there. The Coupon King. He trained for Martucci. Let him do whatever he wanted. And just a full of life guy. Always had a smile. Always had a story. He went down, and all of a sudden, I think about 4 or 5 years after I got there in the mid-90s, he decided to go down and you know, start his farm down there, and and do what he did and became one of the best at it, getting horses ready, buying and selling. I don't think you'll meet too many people around the racetrack that when you mention his name, you don't get a smile. Always had a story and just big and larger than life. So I'm going to miss Jimmy Crupie. You know, I was glad that I went to Ocala this year in March and was able to see him, there in his splendor there, wheeling around in the golf cart and then the backside of Ocala there, telling stories there. So we're going to miss Jimmy Crupie, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, we're going to talk. It should have occurred to me that you know, in your time at Jersey, that you would have overlapped while he was training. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the, like I said, he's, I guess you won't meet anybody that's met him that won't immediately come with a smile on their face and have a story or two. So, sad to see that. Sad to see that.
We're going to talk to Todd before we wrap up today. And Todd in particular, always dreaming is the Derby winner that Crupie created from a young horse, but Uncle Mo is the one that really, I think is the, if you were writing a book, Mike Rapoli, and basically Crupie went and told Rapoli that I got a horse here you have to have. And, it changed the course of things for Mike Rapoli. I mean, who was doing well, but, the Uncle Mo was the big horse, the breakthrough horse, really.
Yeah. He always liked to see other people do good too. You know, always trying to help people out. You needed a couple bucks or you need a little advice. You went to go see Jimmy and JJ and he would help you out. So he was always happy when someone else did good too. That's what made him such a good man.
I appreciate you adding to that chorus, Hammer. A couple of other news and notes from the West Coast Outpost.
I tell you, continuing on here with the 3-day week, this seems to have evolved into the way to go right now. I guess it's 4-day week. Four days this week with Memorial Day. I still can't get that it's Memorial Day already. It's pretty wild. But the racing has gone well. Yesterday there was a CHRB meeting that, they tape these things. They put them on the air, which I don't get it. And I tell you what, it was like the gong show yesterday. They have, and I say that because they have a comment period before the meeting starts, and people are allowed to, put in cards and get up and comment. And I'm going to say this went on for over an hour. We had, all the animal activists, and instead of Chuck Winter, it was like Chuck Barrett trying to control some of these people that came up and commented and really turned it into a circus. I don't know why. Yes, the meetings need to be public, and they are public, but I still don't understand why they need to broadcast them around so people can listen to this, the stuff that goes on. Anyway, they're trying to get a few things done here and, some disruptions with some of the animal activists there. And you want to go back and listen to it, you can. But it's, we're starting to get things a little bit straightened out here. Del Mar had to give their pitch. When I say pitch, the formality of going before the board to apply for their dates, which is done everywhere in every jurisdiction, as a formality. And it was interesting that there was some thought that maybe they would, because Del Mar runs 5 days a week, and they've been running 3 days a week here, and Del Mar decided to say, we're going to go five, which is a good decision, and did say that if it, they'll test the waters early, and if they need to run a race or two less on some of the days, they will. So that people need to hear out here that, Del Mar is full speed ahead and it's going to happen. And I hope they get their condition book out soon with, so people can get some hope in their hands, so to speak, that it's going to go on. But I'm hoping that, we've kind of quote hit bottom out here with all the things that could possibly happen. and take a little siesta-ish break with Los Alamitos, which will start immediately after the meet ends here on June 23rd, 24th, whatever that Sunday is. And then kind of have a rebirth of California racing at Del Mar. And I think there's a lot of people just looking forward to turning the page and getting going again down there. So that's one of the things happening out here. You know, we have a brand new racetrack that's opening up today in the West as well. We should probably mention Arizona Downs.
Mm-hmm.
Opens up, and that's in a town called, looks like it's called Prescott, but for the locals, it's Prescott. So it's kind of like the Louisville thing. You know, you walk in and say, I'm going to Louisville. You don't say Prescott, you say Prescott. So if you wheel into town there. But anyway, I'm out kind of a resortish type place near Sedona, kind of, and well, a couple hours away. But it's in a town, Prescott, that held racing not too long ago. Yavapai Downs was run there. That's what and they're using the same facility. It's a few miles outside of town. Really cool little spot there. In the summer, obviously, it's a little cooler there, which is why they're not running at Turf Paradise. So I think they run a 35-day meet, probably most on the weekends, run through September. So anyone that's around in the Arizona area that wants to just kind of see some racing up in a nice little area in Arizona there, it's Prescott Downs. Arizona Downs. I keep saying that, but... No, good spot, and we'll see how they do. Like I said, they're starting out today. They'll run this weekend, obviously, and carry on. And Scott Stevens is riding there. I just looked at the overnight. He's named on some on opening day. So
he's going to join us next hour.
Right. That's why I mentioned that. So you can talk to him a little bit about that as well. And congratulations to him winning the George Wolfe Award to join his brother Gary in that endeavor. So that's pretty cool in itself. But so we got Arizona Downs going on out here. Let's see, what else did I have written down? Just more of the same. I tell you, the weather's been really crazy out here. The sun is actually out today, and the sun has been a rarity here for a week or so. Don't get it. It's not normally a May type deal here. Normally May is like great, and we get the June gloom. But anyway, we'll take what we can get. But that's it this weekend. I mean, want to go over some of the races? It's fine, but. They did stack some stakes up. I remember when we did the schedule early, we wanted to try and make this thing a big weekend, and now it's probably the last big weekend live racing. They got a bunch of horses going on here. You know, one of the things I want to talk about, I guess, that does kind of dovetail into the weekend races. Two of the races, they got the Daytona and the Monrovia. Now, they're both turf sprints. And obviously now they're not down the hill. They're 5/8 on the turf. And I see some confusion with some trainers. I'm deciding where to run their horses. So, I mean, there's some hill horses. Let's take the Triple Bend, for instance. Horse in there called Law Abiding Citizen. Loves the hill. 4/10 on the turf, one race on the dirt. Here he could have gone in the Daytona, which normally would have been down the hill. It's 5/8, probably too short, 5/8 on the turf. So Mark's decided to try this horse on the dirt, going 7/8 probably because of the distance. Majestic Eagle, another horse in there. Never won a race on the dirt. He's a turf, he's got nothing but turf for him. But rather than try and go 5/8 on the turf, which is probably not his gig, he's decided to go 7/8 on the dirt in the Triple Bend. So I'm seeing, starting to see some of that, whether, you know, having to decide what to do with their horses, and the 6.5 was such a great spot for horses to run that you could try them on the, you know, longer horses. You could shorten them up to 6.5. It didn't matter. If you had some sprinters, you could try, and if you had horses running, you know, 3/4, you could try them 6.5 on the turf. So it wasn't that much out of line. But just in this little, what we've seen this weekend here, it's depending on what's going to happen in the future, if they decide to discontinue the hill, which I sure hope they don't, Some of the horsemen are going to have to make some decisions like they have here if their horses belong here with that 5/8 deal. So it's a new wrinkle that you'll see here. I'm not a big fan of 5/8 turf only because I grew up, never seeing it because we had the hill. So you'll see some horses in that you're going to go, what's he doing in here? I actually thought a couple of them maybe entered the wrong place. Kentinka, Hollendorfer's horse has been sprinting and has never even touched the turf. He went the other way. I thought maybe entered him in the wrong race. He's in the Daytona going 5/8 on the turf instead of the Triple Bend going 7/8 on the dirt. So when you see some of these horses, it's maybe with some of the dilemma that these trainers are going and trying to find an area where their horses belong when normally they would just run down the hill and everything would be fine. So this is another dynamic of what's going on here. And I don't know if they've made a firm decision on whether they're going to, I don't think the rest of the meet they're going to see the hill, but hopefully in the future we will. So yeah. Just another wrinkle to the puzzle here.
Agreed. Yeah. It became my favorite. You taught me how. You taught me how to handicap it and became, one of my favorite, one of my favorite races in the sport, the downhill race. So. We're going to talk to Quigley later in this hour. So we'll hit a few more. And it's a big weekend leading up. They'll draw today for the Gold Cup. And I do see our man Chad Schexnader in New Orleans tells me that Lone Sailor is out there to compete against Gift Box. So
it's a good spot. Mono quarter. Lone Sailor, he's kind of improving, and he'll be fine in there. It'll be a 5/6 horse field, we'll move on. Like I said, we're at the just getting the feeling of the people that I'm talking to that, just want to turn that calendar to June and start fresh. So, but the sun is out, so that's a good thing. And good thing is you're on the radio and we get to listen to you, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. But enjoy. Say hi to Quigley and say hi to Todd, and always a pleasure, and thanks for having us.
Not at all. Hammer, I appreciate it. Rick Hammerly, everybody, away they go on your Twitter machine. Away we go. We'll take probably our last break of the morning, and we've got a lot to do in this last hour with Ed DeRosa, as well as Scott Stevens, Tom Quigley, Todd Pletcher. Stay with us.